Welcome to the My Morning After podcast. Before we get to the juicy conversation, please bear with us while we get through some essential information. It'll only take about 30 seconds. I promise. The My Morning After podcast is brought to you by Ella One, the most effective morning after pill. Ella One is a film-coated tablet for emergency contraception and contains uloprostyl acetate. Always read the label. Verify the most effective morning after pill claim at ellaone.co.uk/verify. The opinions you're about to listen to in this podcast belong to the individuals expressing them and do not indicate the views or opinions of Ella One. None of the healthcare professionals in this podcast series endorse any medicinal brands or products. Oh, it's you again. And me again, on the My Morning After podcast, part of the hashtag My Morning After campaign by Ella One, the most effective morning after pill. Excuse me, let me just check my watch. Yes, hang on, it's stop the outdated stigma connected to emergency contraceptives time. My Morning After is all about getting rid of the embarrassment, misinformation, shame and blame connected to the morning after pill and replacing them with facts, freedom of choice, and feeling like it's a-okay to speak your truth about the realities of sex. To find out more about what Ella One is all about, and to read the morning after stories sent in by real people, go to mymorningafter.co.uk. The voice you're hearing now is that of me, Alex Fox, a broadcaster, journalist, sex educator, and someone who's chuffed as a happy steam engine to be your host. In this episode, I'm joined by badass journalist and author Kieran Yates and illustrator Natalie Byrne. We talk about the representation of contraception, or lack of, in film and TV, plus your honest, revealing morning after stories. Ready to roll? Lights, camera, action. First up, I've got Kieran Yates, a journalist and broadcaster who writes primarily about culture and politics on platforms such as the BBC and The Guardian. Kieran, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
No sweat. I was looking at your Twitter feed recently and noticed that you've been doing a lot of work focusing on the need for legal aid so that anybody who's entering into a court battle has access to decent legal representation so they're not automatically on the back foot.
I mean, I feel like I should try and use Twitter for jokes, but yeah, generally that is kind of what I've been writing and thinking about a lot recently. So for context, it basically refers to what a state-related death is. So that could be anything from dying in social housings, as we saw via Grenfell. It could be deaths we saw in Hillsborough. It could be a death in a police custody. And basically, the legislation from the Ministry of Justice is saying that there are cases where you might not be able to fund your legal bills if that happens. So if that happened, if you've suffered a state-related death, then you might have to foot the bill for this. And of course, for many, many families, it's huge numbers of money. So there is a campaign that I'm trying to get behind with Inquest at the moment, which is basically saying, if that happens to you, you should be able to access legal aid. You should be able to try and fight for justice and take to the courts.
And of course, the threat of an overwhelming, looming bill might put a lot of people off seeking justice.
But this is the thing, you know, and obviously, you know, because you've done lots of work around sexual health and who does and doesn't have access to it. So It kind of fits very well into this whole conversation. You know, this is government policy, which isn't serving minority groups effectively. So if you're vulnerable, either financially or from class or from your immigration status, you are less likely to have access to legal aid. And then, as you know, that also means that you have less access to things like sexual health awareness. And all of these things are connected. So one issue connects to various issues, but one thing is the same, which is usually that if you're on the receiving end of that, you're generally the same kind of person.
Natalie is an illustrator who uses her talent to tackle subjects such as menstruation. She is the author of the inclusive book Period, which aims to bust myths around the time when you've got your painters in. So yeah, using painting to do that, Natalie. 10% of net profits from each book sold are donated to Bloody Good Period, which is a charitable organisation providing menstrual supplies to people like asylum seekers, refugees, and those who can't afford them. Natalie, when it comes to the Crimson Wave, we are drowning in superstitions and bogus beliefs. Were there any oddities that you discovered in your menstrual delvings, so to speak?
I think the one that kept popping up was, especially internationally, that periods are seen as dirty. And that is something that really affects people's lives. And it still is in the Western world. You know, we hide our tampon when we go to the toilet. There's loads of myths about the moon. The moon is not, apparently doctors have evidence that it's got not much to do with the moon, but there are a lot of people that still really believe that.
I saw somebody recently who was using menstrual blood as a face mask in an attempt to start conversations, which I would say is bold.
Vogue did an article about feeding plants with menstrual blood. Feeding plants with...
What, like Venus flytraps?
No, like pouring your menstrual blood from a menstrual cup into
plant the soil. Pot. Yeah, I was imagining a kind of Little Shop of Horrors scenario here. Like, feed me, Seymour. Feed me your tampons. My goodness, we've got graphic very quickly here. speaking of menstruation, a hot topic right now where you both might be united in your views is the film, the Oscar-winning film, in fact, Period, End of Sentence, which focuses on period poverty in India, but it hasn't been without its controversies. Kieran, have you heard of this?
Yes, so I was aware of the documentary beforehand. Of course, it came off the back of a huge Bollywood movie from a couple of years ago called Padman, which was kind of a cinematic representation of, you know, Padman, who built this machine to make sanitary hygiene products for women. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff written about in mainstream press in India and Times of India and so on about, you know, wow, this is so myth busting and wow, like, you know, this is a change and this is really radical. I think for me, what has been most interesting about this is reflecting on the activism that's already been done in India. So often you can kind of get these mono narratives about a place, can't you? You know, women in India don't talk about their periods. South Asian women are really ashamed about this kind of thing. And while that is true in some elements, of course, like it is kind of globally, what is often missed from what's happening in India is that there's loads of amazing, inspiring activism that actually I think that we can learn a lot from. So I'm thinking about a few years ago when there was the goods and service tax was increased to something crazy at 12%, and kind of feminist groups and, you know, feminist student groups from Delhi and Mumbai kind of came out and were like, absolutely not. So the All India Democratic Women's Association, bit mouthful, they started sending pads to parliament with things written on them with like bleed without tax.
Notepads.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then in Delhi Uni, people started sticking pads on the walls and did exhibitions with titles like Come and See the Blood on My Skirt. And there were huge hashtags called Blood Tax. And, you know, all of this grassroots activism was really happening. And I personally just felt really inspired by this. And I think that it's important for us to see these moments like the Oscar win and, you know, see these kind of new conversations happening, but always reflect on the work that's being done on a grassroots level.
What did you think about the film, Natalie? Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I really love it. I thought it was made so well, and it's great to see something like that get an Oscar because it will draw more attention. There were so many headlines about it, and I think that was really powerful to see in headlines. Yeah, I thought it was great.
Also quite sweet and quite funny to see how kind of editors and publications have tried to write the headline here, like,
yes,
period film, or like a film about the time of the, you know, and then yeah, suddenly it shows you that actually there, it isn't just kind of, you know, this backwards country that don't talk about their periods. Actually, we're talking about, in a British context, the way in which people even report that story feels slightly uncomfortable.
Well, there's a lot that media, from the press to movies to radio to podcasts to more grassroots zines and movements and communities, can do to educate and empower women more generally, but also about subjects like emergency contraception. And to that end, the My Morning After movement is trying to get women to share their personal experiences of what they've gone through when seeking emergency contraception. This story is from a woman who wishes to remain anonymous, but she's 18 and she's based in Wiltshire. She says,
I take the morning after pill on two occasions. The first time was after a one-night stand I wish hadn't happened. However, it wasn't until 2 days after that I went to get the morning after pill. I'd taken a pregnancy test the morning after, not fully understanding how and when you should take a test. Luckily for me, my sister informed me that I could still take the morning after pill, so I went to my local pharmacy and avoided an unplanned pregnancy. The second occasion, I had unprotected sex with a friend. I didn't ask him to use a condom because I felt too embarrassed, like it would make me seem square or something. So I got the morning after pill by myself the next day. I was even too embarrassed to mention to the pharmacist that I was still in full-time education. I was worried they would judge me.
for me, there are just so many points in this story where there's a lack of information, a lack of awareness and education. It's really steeped in shame and fretful worry. Did you relate to anything in that?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things. If you have, either if you've heard about the process or you've experienced the process firsthand, what you will know, or if you've experienced the firsthand more than once, that there actually isn't an ascribed process. So you might go to one pharmacist and they might take you into a room and they might tell you, you know, about your rights and, you know, go through some paperwork. You might go to another place where there's actually just a queue and you're having, you know, you're given a morning after pill then and there. There might be another time where you are paying for it over the counter and they ask you to take it there and then. And other people might say you can take it home and take it as you wish. So when we're kind of talking about the issue of the actual logistics of taking a morning after pill, it's even difficult to say that there's one thing to expect because there isn't a one specific way of that whole process happening. And I think that that is can be confusing if you are quite young or you've heard something. You can imagine, can't you?
I think it's confusing at any age, right. Really.
That's true. But it's like if you had, perhaps if you are maybe you're a teenager and let's say you're more susceptible to what your peers would say. And they're saying, okay, this is the process. This is what happens. You go da 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 da. And then you go and it's completely different. I think that could throw you for a bit of a loop. So I totally understand all the confusion around the process.
You do not need a prescription to buy emergency contraception. You can get it over the counter in a pharmacy or even buy it online from a reputable source. You can purchase it in advance so it's on hand if you need it, for example, if you're going on holiday.
Yeah, I think that is so true what you said. Like you can give as much helpful advice, but there is no system when it comes to it. It can be different. And I've had experiences where when I was younger, I had positive experience. And then as I got older, I actually went to uni in Sheffield and had a bad experience with someone who was very shameful and judgmental. And I was older. So I was like, in my head, I was like, this guy, you know, I know what he's doing and it's not working on me. But if I was younger, oh my God, that would have really affected me. And so you can have a really different experience depending on who you're talking to or who's, because you never know what their opinions and their judgments are on you. And you take that on as well, not as well as the system, the person and what their personal views and how they are treating you, talking to you. Because I got taken back into like a back room and like asked tons of questions. And yeah, so I think that it's a thing that we should definitely talk about.
Locality, about area, about, you know, assumptions, about all of this kind of thing. And, you know, if you were a different kind of person, you might be completely put off by that. But it's also about the role of the man in this story, you know, or your partner in this story, isn't it? It's like so much of the time, which I'm sure you know, when you hear about the morning after pill process, it is this singular responsibility, or that your partner isn't so much part of the story. You know, maybe he's not part of, you know, coming in with you or maybe driving you or, you know, going with you or splitting the cost of a pill. And so I wonder when I hear these accounts, it just makes me reflect on how much men are part of this conversation or part of our morning after pill stories, if you want to frame them like that. How much, you know, is there a conversation before saying, I'm going to go and do this? Or if you're not, what would that be their reaction? What was their reaction sort of 8 hours prior or whoever when you were having that conversation about safe sex or whether you weren't? I just feel like I don't know how helpful it is all the time to have an abundance of stories that center women completely and makes it their own responsibility.
I agree. And I also think that it's less helpful to have an abundance of educational movements which are aimed solely at women, because the more I encounter these kind of tales, the more it strikes me that if men knew more about contraceptives, if men knew more about female bodies, if men knew more about the menstrual cycle, then we would all be in a better place. This story for me as well also highlights how women themselves don't always have a full grasp of how their bodies work. This idea of doing a pregnancy test straight away and not knowing whether or not that might work or how much it's dependable. You must come across that a lot, Natalie. People not really having a full understanding of their own innards.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what particularly stood out in this story was I felt too embarrassed to ask about contraception, and I think that that needs to change. Like, we need to change so that before anything happens, it's like, hey, are you on the pill? Like, that needs to change. And I think that so much around all of these issues are. It comes to education, and the lack of education and knowledge leads to shame and feeling embarrassed to talk about it.
Ella, want to know the truth? You can carry out most pregnancy tests from the first day of a missed period. If you're not sure when your next period's due, do the test at least 21 days after you last had unprotected sex.
Do you know what I come across a lot in my profession, at least in my capacity as a sex educator, is there is lots of advice in magazines and you hear this kind of slung about very carefree manner. Oh, you know, we need to communicate more about condoms. We should talk more about contraception. But we don't really give anybody frameworks or devices or models of what that communication should look like. It's all very well saying, oh, yeah, you should absolutely speak about it with your partner. If you're somebody who feels nervous or embarrassed, then you don't know how to broach the topic. So I'd like to see education giving people lines that they could use or more suggestions. But why do we think, given that doing the horizontal mambo, getting down to business, knocking boots, whatever you want to call it, why when we're willing to be sexual with someone, do we find it so cringingly embarrassing to talk about contraception? Why when we're getting naked in front of someone, are our faces origamiing themselves with awkwardness about asking about condoms?
I was going to say, I think it's a couple of things, but I think the line that I always come back to in my own head is that my feminism is intersectional, so my sexual education should be too. And I think that this is something that government gets wrong a lot mm-hmm. of the time with social policy, and also media gets wrong with its representation. So when we're talking about cultural attitudes, the different kinds of women and non-binary people who are susceptible to this information, you realize that, yeah, actually, intersectional cultural attitudes do fit into this kind of thing. It's like, you know, last year there was a big story about, you know, the big AIDS testing campaign, and they were going to certain areas that were really dominated by South Asian communities in London. And even though there was, you know, a van, you know, it was very open, and they were saying, just come and get tested, there's no shame, it's fine. Of course, people didn't do that because they were like, no, I know everybody in the community. I know that my auntie is going to see me and they're going to snitch, or like, I know everybody on this road. So what government need to be doing via social policy is speaking to these charitable organizations, saying who is the demographic, what really resonates and what speaks to them, and how can we build frameworks off the back of that?
You're so right, because so often with things like sex education, we try and do a catch-all approach. I know that the law has changed recently. Unfortunately, it's been pushed back from September 2019 to 2020. But as of that time, sex ed in English schools is going to be compulsory, age-appropriate sex education. And whilst I totally welcome that news, and I think it's a great step, I am concerned that a lot of people think that the problem, whoosh, has now magically been solved, or will be from that moment. But it won't be. Natalie, by using your illustrative skills, you've harnessed kind of a different way of communicating to people about things like menstruation. What have you learned through that process, through taking a non-standard route to get people chatting and talking in constructive ways?
Well, I kind of just wanted to talk about it the way that I talk about periods, like the way that I laugh about them and that we joke about them. And it wasn't until kind of after the book that everyone started saying like those kinds of things. I think that unfortunately a lot of people's stories haven't been told, and the way that we talk about things hasn't been true in media, and periods are really hilarious and I have lots of funny stories about them. And so it was very natural to be like, oh, this is how I'm going to talk about it, the way that I talk about it in my real life. So yeah. It was
true to you.
Yeah. And also, you know, true to anyone that's been in the ladies' toilets, and like, we're always like kind of giggling, or if you've been to a sleepover and you kind of like talk about, you know, all those taboo topics. Yeah, it was quite natural. So, but I think that just goes to show that a lot of people's stories have not been told, and a lot of people's voices, like, and the way that they talk isn't published.
And also that there is room for speaking about these topics using humour, or using illustration, or using films or animation. The more ways that we can offer information, the more people that are likely to access it, who will find it relatable and see that it speaks to them. On that note, Kieran, can you tell me anything about the way you think that maybe women who've immigrated into the UK are treated differently when it comes to things like sex by medical professionals, by their peers, and by the media? Is this a group that we are failing to serve?
We know that, you know, South Asian depictions, you know, stereotypes or, you know, of meekness or, you know, whatever in East Asian communities. And, you know, and then we've probably heard some stereotypes. I think all of this stuff, although it is historical, actually really filters into our contemporary media depictions. And you can really see that, I think. You really understand, you know, sometimes nurses might think, oh, well, you come from a certain kind of community, you probably don't know about this. Or maybe you're probably too shy to talk to your husband about this. And you say, I'm not married, I'm not shy.
Yeah.
I was born here, what are you talking about?
So maybe those professionals think that they are being compassionate and thoughtful and catering to that person's specific needs, but really they're basing their approach on a model that's really outdated and stereotypical.
Right. But I mean, as long as the I actually personally think that as long as the information, as long as the government are making moves to educate communities of color specifically to their specific needs, that's okay. I think when we're talking about curriculum and we're talking about that kind of stuff, we're really kind of, I really agree with Natalie in terms of this peer learning. We all know that the conversations about sex happen with our friends, with our cool older sisters, with our mates, you know, with like that one mum who's like your friend who you can chat about certain things. So we need to kind of take that kind of peer model of like a cool older sister or whoever and bring them into schools. You know, there's no reason why, you know, the three of us or whoever wouldn't come and say those sorts of things. You know, yes, this is what it's like. Yes, it is awkward sometimes searching for a condom, but actually it's not really that awkward. And yes, you know, you might watch a film or, you know, watch a TV show where suddenly the moment is lost because you've reached for a condom. But actually, in real life, that's not really how it is. And if it is like that, this is the way that you can try and counteract it. But even on a more mainstream level, I mean, my baby sister is 21. She's Angel. But even like hearing about her, like her huge gaps in her knowledge, I'm like, are you joking? Like, yeah, and I've forgotten, you know, it's been a while since I was in school. So I forgot actually the disservice that young people have as part of their curriculum when we're talking about just the basics. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the kind of stories that you guys are hearing, but I'm hearing a lot of mad stories when I'm doing workshops and talking to people's awareness of sex, and they just really have huge gaps.
Ellamond's research says that about 3/4 of women who had unprotected sex didn't seek emergency contraception afterwards. If they were hoping to cross their fingers and that a pregnancy just wouldn't happen, well, that's not really how biology works. Did you know that Ellawun reduces your risk of falling pregnant to just 9 in 1,000 when taken within 24 hours of unprotected sex?
I noticed in my research there is a huge difference between what area of England you are in. Mm-hmm. From my survey, I did a survey about periods and it was astounding. Like the people who lived in the Midlands had like education about periods, knew what it was when they got it. And actually the saddest thing is I grew up in Buckinghamshire, which is a very privileged area. And the saddest stories were always from Buckinghamshire. I had no idea what was happening. I felt traumatized. Like, and it just goes to show that again, like where you are in England, it has such an effect, and it affects body confidence. Like the girls that I know from the other areas that got taught about it are very confident, and it's very sad that that has an effect on where you are a bit.
That is such a good point, that I think sometimes we presume that in places of privilege or in situations of privilege, mm-hmm. that people are absolutely going to be given the best education, the most solid information.
Doesn't it also really perpetuate this idea that the fundamental issue is about finding your voice? So we actually, what it focuses on is this idea that women across all backgrounds or class backgrounds in the UK specifically have trouble finding their voice. And so that is a much larger conversation. You have trouble finding it in the classroom and then in the boardroom and then in a workplace and then negotiating your money and then finding childcare. And of course you might struggle in the bedroom then. That is just another space, right? So even though there is very particular needs for very particular kinds of people, the constant appears to be, when we look at data across the whole of society, that women have trouble finding their voice in certain spaces. And so the bedroom is just part of that. It's just another space where actually it is very difficult to say really crucial things.
And then another question that you brought up earlier was about how, like, how are you going to ask the question about contraception when you're already, like, naked and you feel uncomfortable? And, like, I personally had an eating disorder when I was a teenager, so I was, like, having sex and I'm like, hate my body. So it's like a mixture of just so much intense emotions, and then you have to think, oh my god, I hope I'm not getting pregnant right now. So it's like everything, you know, and it's complex. But I think there's a lot of issues when you are feeling intimate with someone. You worry a lot about, what I did, I worried a lot about how I looked. Does this person like me?
A couple of years ago, I was doing a workshop with a group of girls who were 15 to 18. And it was around the time when Girls was really big, as in like Lena Dunham Girls was like really huge. So we did this exercise where I was like, okay, go back, watch the whole first series of Girls and note down, I do a tally of every single sex scene where there's a condom used. And they came back, and I think it was something like 4 or 6. And so it was like, and coming back, and I think that that's the third strand. It is about cultural, you know, media representations, because this stuff does have an impact. And it, I think that sometimes it feels like you're not fighting the good fight because you're not putting pressure on government and petitions if you're saying, oh, our media needs to be more representative, or, you know, this TV show needs this. But actually, that is so crucial. That is what you need to see. Of course, you need to see things that, you know, you see condoms, you see these kinds of conversations in a very normalized way, because it has huge impact. And then when they came back, so that, you know, when the girls are coming back after their like girls binge, they came back and they were like, yeah, but like, fair enough, they don't show condoms, like it's awkward. And it's like, yeah, I mean, for us,
that's the point. That's what we need to change.
You're totally on the back foot. Like, imagine being in that classroom. I didn't know what to say. I was like, no, it's not. You know, it's really difficult to fight that fight because, you know, look at what you're exposed to. Of course, you think it's awkward and weird and you don't want to bring it up.
What about depictions of using emergency contraception on the telly or in movies?
I think the only contraception I've seen is in the film Knocked Up.
Yeah, that didn't go so well.
Yeah, it didn't go so well. I think that's the only time I can remember. I really don't know. I don't think so anywhere else.
There was a scene in the last season of Master of None, where basically they had had sex and then they went. And what I really loved about the way that that was depicted actually was the kind of stoical sighing normalization of it, which is sometimes how it can feel for certain people in relationships. And then, you know, they sort of get up and then they go and then, you know, they sort of get it and there's a bit of a conversation around it. They don't really know each other that well. But what I like about it is that it's totally normalized that the central character, Aziz Ansari, would be part of this conversation and he knows about it. And I feel like that would be kind of a nice place to get to, wouldn't it? I mean, when we're talking about film and TV and we're talking about the morning after pill, for me, the best place that we'd get to is when it is just totally normalized, when it's like met with like a sigh and like, oh God, as opposed to like, hello, now we're going to do this thing. And, you know, and I think that that's where we always want to get, isn't it? We always want to just normalize those difficult things in real life and, you know, in fabricated life.
Ella One actually made history earlier this year by showing the first ever morning after pill advert on TV and in cinemas when their My Morning After ad was broadcast.
It would be brilliant if there was a widely relatable, quite positive depiction of something like use of the morning after pill that people could hold in their minds if they found themselves in that situation.
And the whole dance around it, like, okay, so what do we split the cost of it then? Like, what do you do? It's like splitting the bill on a day. It's like, okay, is there like a role for you? Like, should I put more in? Should I get it myself? How are we going to get there? Do I pay for the, you know, like all of this kind of thing. Those are like the funny bits of realism that actually happens if you're having these conversations. Or, you know, okay, what should I wear to go get the morning after pill? I don't want to look like I don't want it too young. Like, yeah. I don't want to look like this. And really what that really flags up is something in yourself, isn't it? You're aware of the gaze when you walk into that space and you don't want to be judged. And so there's loads of funny things or, you know, insightful things.
I had a friend talk about getting the morning after pill recently and she was fretting about what she should buy with it.
Right.
She didn't want to buy this singular product. So she was like, well, I really fancy some ice cream, but I feel like, you know, a tub of raspberry ripple and the morning after pill is maybe a weird combo. That's a very strange ice cream sundae. Or, you know, do I pick up some cough sweets or some tissues, or is that too sex related?
Yeah. I get like posh white lady receptionist voice when I get there. I'm like, hello there. I was just inquiring about a bit of contraception. Suddenly I'm like, whoa, where does this even come from? Doesn't sound like me at all. Right. But it's, yeah, there's a bit of like performance and performativity, even, you know, for someone who's been working in the field and kind of knows about this stuff. And you know that none of it is really real, but when you feel it, you feel it.
A little bit like giving people easy ways to suggest condom usage. If we can normalize and help people to relax about asking for the morning after pill and having reasonable expectations of what that might entail, then I think that we can genuinely empower them to make that choice, if it's right for them, an easier one. Your book, Period, is very inclusive in that it recognizes that it's not just people who identify as female who can have periods. Trans people can have periods. You don't just have to be heterosexual. And a lot of the conversation around menstruation often focuses on, oh, well, you know, will I be able to have penetrative sex with my penis-owning boyfriend? You include LGBTQ+ people really well in your book. Was there anything that you learned from that process that you think others might be able to benefit from in their efforts to educate?
Maybe how easy it was to do that. Like, I had my mum, I showed my mum chapters of the book throughout the whole thing, didn't tell her anything about how that it was trans inclusive. My mum is South American and that has complications. And
that was very diplomatic.
I love my mum, but yeah, she has struggles with accepting LGBTQ+ issues. And so I could tell the story about my, I'll tell the story. So I was very, very nervous of my book launch because I was going to become very aware that it was trans inclusive because I had Kenny, a trans activist, on my period panel. And I had actually a conversation with my publishers because I didn't know if I was going to be able to stay at home because I'm living with my parents at the moment, because I didn't know what the implications of that would be. And my publishers were like, you can stay at our house if something happens and we'll figure it out. And on the day, I was very, very nervous and Kenny spoke and it was amazing and I cried. And then the next day, my mum was like, I want lists of all the trans activists because I want to do my research. And I thought he was so brave what he said, and I like welling up now thinking about it.
The power of that fluid.
She had read the book several times and it hadn't even engaged into her head that it was different language. It was incredible, I think, just seeing how that has affected her. So yeah, I think it was really easy to make the book trans inclusive. I mean, sometimes it was like, okay, but yeah, it was easy. And people pick it up and who aren't necessarily trans inclusive and don't realize, which I think was a shock to me because I thought it would be very clear, like, this is different. The language we're using is different. But it just goes to show that it's not that hard.
Yeah, inclusivity shouldn't just be for the exclusive members of the woke badge wearing club. I am so heartened by that tale. It's brilliant that you made such an impact on your mum. For me, this conversation has highlighted the fact that we still have a long way to go. There is an awful amount that we need to achieve, but stories like yours and the amazing work that you do also give me hope that it's doable. We can do it, but we're going to need everybody on side. And we need to help people find their voices so that they can use them to keep this movement rolling.
I often feel like, you know, I actually feel the opposite to you in terms of feeling like lots of stuff is being happening. We're making loads of headway and feeling like you're within an echo chamber. Because I feel like I often feel like, wow, nothing is being done.
Right.
My community, by which I mean the South Asian community, really is not ready to kind of hear a lot of this stuff. A lot of the workshopping I do really shows that, wow, there's such a way to go. But actually what I'm really heartened by is these two ideas, which is one that, you know, we can't win all the battles that we fight, but it's still worth fighting because some of that does get through. And two, that there are these place-holding moments in history that we're a part of. So, you know, you might remember where you were when you were watching the Repeal the Eighth stuff happening. Mm-hmm. You might remember where you were the first time your mum kind of heard a story about trans sexual health and experience and really understood it and felt it. Each of us have these personal and political placeholders which show you how far we are moving, or at least how much of what we're saying, or, you know, what people are saying is being heard. And I think that that is the point, isn't it? You know, I don't know, under a very conservative government 20 years ago, even a podcast like this could exist with, you know, a huge listenership and, you know, not a massive moral outrage. So things do change, but they don't always look the way that you want them to. But I think that, you know, I suppose all of us here and being able to have these conversations is a sort of insight into where things could be going next.
Well, let's cross our fingers and also hope that for some people listening to this podcast, they will have one of those memorable moments if they ever need to consider whether emergency contraception is an option for them, then perhaps they will recall having heard something from us. To keep up with this podcast, please do subscribe and follow. And for the latest news and conversations from Ella One, seek out at Ella One UK on Twitter and Instagram. If you have a Morning After story to share, you can do so at mymorningafter.co.uk or by using the hashtag MyMorningAfter. Join in, join us, and join together in rejecting the unhelpful and unwarranted stigma surrounding emergency contraception. My Morning After, putting taboo to bed.